Chapter 61. The waitress came by and picked up our empty plates and took our orders for pie. Then she went away again, and Devereaux was left looking at me, a little crestfallen. A little embarrassed, I thought. She said,
"I did a stupid thing."
I said, "What kind of stupid thing?"
"A hunt," she said, "now and then, just for fun. Deer, mostly. Just for something to do. I give the meat to the old folks like Emily McClatchy. They don't eat well otherwise. Pork, sometimes, if a neighbor's butchering a pig, if the neighbor thinks to share. But that doesn't always happen. Sometimes the neighbors can't afford to share."
"I remember," I said. "Emmeline had deer meat in the pot when we were there the first time. She offered us lunch. You declined." She nodded.
"No point in giving and then taking away. I got that deer a week ago. I couldn't take it back to the hotel, obviously. So I used my dad's place. I always have since I came back here. That's a good trestle. But then you came up with your theory about Janice Chapman. I didn't know you very well at that point. I thought you might get on the phone to HQ. I had visions of Blackhawks in the air, finding every trestle in the county. So I sent you off to ID the wrecked cars so you would be out of the way for an hour, and I went over and dug up the blood."
"Tests would have proved it came from an animal."
"I know," she said. "But how long would that have taken? I don't even know where the nearest lab is. Atlanta, maybe? It could have taken 2 weeks or more. And I can't afford to be under a cloud for 2 weeks or more. I literally can't afford it. This is the only job I have. I don't know where I'd get another one. And voters are weird. They always remember the suspicion, and they never remember the outcome."
I thought about my old pal Stan Lowry, back on post with his want ads. A brave new world for all of us. "Okay," I said. "But it was a fairly dumb thing to do."
"I know it was. I panicked a little bit."
"Do you know other hunters? And other trestles?"
"Some."
"Because I still think that's how those women were killed. I don't see how it could be done any other way."
"I agree. Which is why I panicked."
"So sooner or later, we might need to get those Blackhawks in the air."
"Unless we find Reed Riley first and ask him some questions."
"Reed Riley is gone," I said. "He's probably Army liaison at Thule Air Force Base by now."
"Which is where?"
"Northern Greenland," I said. "The top of the world. It's certainly the Air Force's most remote place. I was there once. I was on a C-5 that had a problem. We had to land there. It's part of the distant early warning system. No sunlight for 4 months of the year. They've got radar that can see a tennis serve 3,000 miles away."
"Did you get their phone number?"
I smiled. "We're going to have to do it another way. I'll see what comes out of the woodwork the day after tomorrow." She said nothing in reply to that. We ate our pie slowly. We had time to kill. At that point, the midnight train was probably just easing its way out of the yards in Biloxi. Devereaux was still worried about the old man in the hotel, and she didn't want to repeat her charade at the top of the stairs. So I gave her my key, and we left the diners separately, 10 minutes apart, which left me with the check and time for a third cup of coffee. Then I strolled down the street and nodded to the guy behind the desk and headed up the stairs and tapped on my own door. Devereaux opened up instantly, and I stepped inside. She had taken her shoes and her gun belt off, but everything else was still in place. Uniform shirt, uniform pants, ponytail. All good. We went at it like a junkie heats a spoon, half fast, half slow, full of intense anticipation, willing to make the investment, barely able to wait for the payoff. She started by taking the elastic out of her hair, shaking it loose, smiling at me from behind its thick, dark curtain. She undid the first three buttons on her shirt, and the weight of her nameplate and badges and stars dragged the loose material askew and showed me a deep triangle of bare skin. I took off my shoes and my socks and pulled my shirt tails out of my pants. She put one hand on the fourth button on her shirt and the other on the button on the waistband of her pants, and she said,
"Your choice."
Which was a tough choice to make, but I thought long and hard about it and came to a firm conclusion. I said, "Pants." And she popped the button, and a long minute later she was barefoot and bare-legged in just her tan uniform shirt. I said, "Now you get the same choice." And she went the other way, and I took off my shirt. This time she asked about my shrapnel scar, and I gave her the short version, which was all about unfortunate timing at the start of my career and a routine liaison visit to a Marine encampment in Beirut, Lebanon, and being passed by a truck which then blew itself up near the barracks entrance, 100 yards from where I was standing. She said,
"I heard about an Army MP there. That was you?"
I said, "I'm not sure who else was there."
"You went into the ruin and helped people."
"Only by accident," I said. "I was looking for a medic, for myself. I could see what I had eaten for dinner the night before."
"You got the Silver Star."
"And blood poisoning," I said. "I could have done without either thing." I undid my waistband button, and she undid the last of her shirt buttons, and then we were in nothing but our underwear. That state of affairs did not endure long. We set my shower running and climbed into the tub together and pulled the curtain. We grabbed soap and shampoo and lathered up and washed each other up and down, side to side, inside and out. No one on earth could have faulted our standards of hygiene or our approach to ensuring them. We stayed in the shower until Toussaint's tank ran cool, and then we grabbed enough towels to make sure we wouldn't put puddles in my bed, and then the serious business began. She tasted warm and slick and soapy, and I'm sure I did too. She was lithe and strong and full of energy. We were very patient. I figured the midnight train was by then north of Columbus, south of Aberdeen, maybe 40 miles and 40 minutes away. And 40 minutes is a good, long time. Halfway through it, there was precious little we didn't know about each other. I knew the way she moved and what she liked and what she loved. She knew the same about me. I got to know the way her heart hammered against her ribs, and the way her ribs moved as she panted, and the difference between one kind of panting and another. She got to know equivalent facts about me, the early warning catch in my throat, the things to do to make my skin flush red, where I liked to be touched, and what drove me absolutely crazy. Then we began a long, slow build-up, with a time certain in mind, like an invading army approaching a D-Day H-hour, like infantrymen watching the beach come closer, like pilots seeing the target grow large in the bomb sights, long and slow, closer and closer, long and slow, for 5 whole minutes. Then eventually, faster and harder, faster and harder, faster and harder. The glass on my bathroom shelf began to tinkle right on cue. It shook and rattled. The pipes in the walls made muffled, metallic sounds. The French doors shook, one sound from the wood, another from the glass, a third from the latch. The floorboards vibrated like drum skins. A discarded shoe rolled right side up. Her sheriff's star beat a tiny tattoo against the wood. The Beretta in my pocket thumped and bounced. The bed head beat on the wall in a rhythm not our own. The midnight train, right on time, all aboard. But this time it was different and wrong. Not us, but the train. Its sound was not the same. Its pitch was low. It was suddenly slowing hard. Its distant rumble was overlaid with the binding, grinding, screeching howl of brakes. I saw in my mind iron blocks jammed against the rims, locked wheels, long showers of superheated sparks in the nighttime air. One car after the other slamming and buffeting the next in front as the mile-long length telescoped together behind the slowing locomotive. Devereaux slipped out from under me and sat up straight, her eyes nowhere, listening hard. The grinding howl kept on going, loud, mournful, primitive, impossibly long, and then, eventually, it started to fade, partly because the train's momentum had carried it far beyond the crossing, and partly because it was finally almost at a stop. By my side, Devereaux whispered,
"Oh, no.